Hello, and welcome to Holden Village. Today's date is Thursday, August 7th, 2003. Today's session is entitled, Give Peace a Place in Colombia, Session 4 of Proclaiming the Year of the Lord's Favor in Our Global Reality, Some New Visions for the Future of God's Earth and God's People, presented by Jim Bowman, number BOJ2003-09. Let's listen in.
The rest of you also, I'm Jim Bowman, and I work with Lutheran World Relief in Washington, D.C., in their Office of Public Policy, and have been here for 2 weeks talking about different aspects of globalization. In our office in Washington, we have four staff people who work on public policy issues, and two of them, half of our staff, are totally working on Colombia issues. So that shows you the amount of resources that we have committed to this area. And I'll talk a little bit about what we do and give you an opportunity maybe to ask some questions. If you are interested in receiving alerts about the situation in Colombia, in terms of action that you might take, or legislation that's being considered in Washington, and an opportunity for you to respond to your elected officials, or if you want to receive an occasional update on what is happening, like about once a month, we put out looks like to me like a two-page. This is done electronically also, so that if you have email access, this can come to you by email. If you're interested in any of those things, just sign up on this yellow sheet afterwards with your name and address. And if you don't have email, we'll mail hard copies out to you. There's multiple copies of both of these that you're welcome to take. Afterwards, they look alike, but they aren't. One is what we call our update. Another one is just a two-page action alert. Also, for those of you who are new, you should know that these sessions are being recorded. That's a warning to any of you not to talk, or maybe to talk a lot more than you ordinarily would, knowing you're going to be on tape. And I have to send a signal. So if it looks like I'm talking to somebody who isn't here, it's because the person who's recording is waiting for me to give them a signal that they can start the recording. So I think we'll go ahead and start the recording now. And I will begin by talking about a resource that we have available or have prepared that can be used in congregations. Titled Hearing the Cry of the People of Colombia. It's a resource that we expect to be used in a variety of settings. Somebody who, you don't have to be an expert on Colombia to use these materials. If you just have a concern for what is happening, you can, and this is also on our website, you can download them directly. You can request a packet, we'll mail it out to you, but you can also just go to our website, and all this stuff is on the website, and you can click on it there and print it out. What it consists of is a leader's guide, complete with opening prayers and closing prayers and questions and information, background information, and also a participant's guide that you could use to hand out to people, and the extent to which they may want to read in advance, it all depends on how eager people are to and committed they are to learn about this, but we think it's a pretty user-friendly resource. And then in the other pocket here, you have different resources, sort of materials that go along with each lesson. There are basically four lesson plans. And they consist of just some background information about the country, statements from the Lutheran Church in Colombia, information about Plan Colombia and the war on drugs, information about the internally displaced, and also advocacy information about how to, if you want to do something about what you learned. So we think it's a pretty good packet, and I just wanted you to be aware that I'm going to leave this packet here in the library as a resource when I leave. So if you want to take a look at it before you leave home, you'll be, I'm not sure where they'll keep it, probably in their resource or checkout materials for the week. Let me tell you how our office has gotten involved in what we call the advocacy side of the work in Colombia. We've had a presence there for about 10 years, and the presence there has not always had an advocacy focus. That's just been very recent. It's only been for about 3 years that we've been involved in the advocacy and policy side of things. Our work there primarily has been with the Protestant church community. The Lutheran church in Colombia is very small. They've been there about as long as Holden Village has been in existence. I think the Lutheran missionaries came there in about 1938 or 39, and there are about 18 congregations, and there are, you know, it's not that large, but they have an important work with the internally displaced. We'll talk a little bit more about that, how that has come about and what it means. But basically, we've been providing some funds and resources. Some of it goes to the Lutheran Church, some of it goes to Protestant Council, and other agencies that are involved in meeting some of the more immediate needs of people who've been displaced. It may be direct food aid, which you usually think of as more humanitarian type aid, but beyond that, it's also projects to help train people to develop some an income and livelihood in the places where they find themselves after being displaced. We've also been supporting some of the efforts of the faith community to be actively involved in conflict resolution, especially at the local levels, where individual congregations find themselves sort of caught in the middle of the conflict, trying to be neutral, and yet even if they try to be neutral, they're considered, if they're in a territory that's controlled by the guerrillas, and if they try to be neutral, they're accused of siding with the paramilitary or the army, so that it creates tremendous difficulties for them. So we provided some funds for some peacemaking efforts that have been going on, but more and more in recent years, we've been asked by our partners there to become involved in some of the policy work here at this end, to try to bring the story of what is happening in Colombia to policymakers in this country, and to try to make an impact on what is happening here. I should mention that we have at least one person from Colombia here, I know you may not feel comfortable. You haven't been here. How long have you been in this country?
Only 4 months.
4 months, mm-hmm. Right. I've encouraged her to participate, but as you would expect, someone who's only been here 4 months may not feel that comfortable in a group like this. But I, again, want to welcome you. If you want to say something, don't hesitate to do that. One of the reasons why we have been as effective as we have been in the work that we do is because one of the persons on our staff is a Colombian. himself. And he is what I call a natural born politician. So he sort of advocacy work just comes so natural to him. His situation is somewhat unique. When he graduated from high school in Columbia a number of years ago, he's in his mid-30s now. But when he graduated from high school as a young man, he scored very high academically and received a scholarship. And he went to, and the scholarship was in Russia. He went to Russia, learned Russian, spent a year learning Russian, got his undergraduate and his graduate degree in Russia in energy planning, came back to Columbia, worked a short time in his, in Columbia we don't call them states, we call them departments. And so if I use the term department, it's a word that you aren't familiar. I mean, we know what a department is at a university or a college, but there, department is a section of a country, geographical section of the country, administrative unit. He went to work there. He's Afro-Colombian, and Afro-Colombians constitute about 20, the figures vary, but about 26% of the population of the country. He then went to work in Bogota for the national government in the planning energy office, and was persuaded by the people in his home territory, his home department, to run for governor. And he ran for governor and he won as a very young man. And in his territory, there was the presence, and we haven't really given this background to it, we'll come to it later. But there were the presence of three armed groups. There were the guerrillas, there were the paramilitaries, and of course there was the army to some extent. Mostly paramilitaries, some guerrillas, and a few army. And it was creating a lot of conflict, a lot of violence, people were suffering. And one of the first things he did was he declared his department a non-militarized zone, and he asked everybody to leave. He asked all the armed actors to leave. Well, that was a foolish thing to do politically if you expected to stay in power. And it wasn't long before he was kidnapped by the paramilitary, and they said that if he did not cooperate with them, that they would begin to kill his family members. He had two. I didn't mention this. He married a Russian woman, and had by this time two boys, and so his family was threatened, and his own life was threatened. He was given some time to decide whether or not he was going to cooperate. And in that time, he was able to arrange with the help of friends and the U.S. Embassy to come to this country separately, because it wasn't safe for them to come together. So about 3 years ago, he came to this country and received political asylum. And 2 years ago, we hired him to work as the coordinator of our U.S. Colombia advocacy project, which we call Give Peace a Place. And so he's really a key to the work that we're doing, because until he came on board, we really had not been able to make very much headway in terms of access to members of Congress, especially the Congressional Black Caucus members. And he's, because of his own African ancestry, he's been able to win friends and respect and credibility. And we find them contacting him quite frequently to give advice and to actually help write some of the legislation that we would like to see enacted. So And the other person that works on Columbia is a young woman who's a recent graduate several years ago of Pacific Lutheran, who has been working on the grassroots side of things, coordinating tours or visits of Colombians coming to this country and visiting members of Congress who are also coming out primarily to the Midwest to targeted areas. And so I'm the only one of the four people in our office who doesn't speak Spanish, so I feel very inadequate, but I'm just awfully glad that we have some of the capable people that we do. A lot of what I might say might be just repetition for those of you who either are Colombian, obviously, or who are familiar with that, but do any of you who are here have special connections in one way or another with Colombia? I mean, have you heard about the situation, or what do you know about it? I don't want to sort of begin at, you know, the capital is this, and the population is this, and you know, the economy is this. But I mean, I've got information that I would like to share with you, especially about the history of the country and why we are where we are today, and sometimes I'm speaking about Lutheran World Belief, other times I'm talking about we as the United States as a country. So if some of you have other kinds of experiences there, have any of you traveled to Colombia? And have any of you been to Colombia? Yeah. So I'm not surprised. It's not a tourist place which attracts a lot of tourists, primarily because the United Nations has basically identified it as the most violent conflict in the Western Hemisphere. Last year, there were over 4,000 people that were killed in that country, and the figures on the internally displaced vary according to who's making the who's doing the counting, but easily over 400,000 people were displaced, so that now fairly conservative figures say that about 2.8 million people in that country have been internally displaced. And this is out of a population of about 39 million. So we're talking about a pretty high percentage of people that have been forced for one reason or another to leave their homes, and many of them go into urban areas or close to urban areas where they can find food and other people to live with, but it's not easy. When we think of Colombia, I guess, when you hear the word Colombia, I would be curious to know what words come to your mind most immediately.
Coffee.
What other words?
Drugs.
Okay.
Oil.
Cocaine. Specifically, anything else?
Military aid.
Wycliffe Bible translators.
Wycliffe, yes. So you must have a contact.
Yes.
My cousin is a translator.
I remember the first time I sat in a workshop at a global mission event, where Luis Murillo Gilberto, who's our Colombian person, did a workshop, and he asked this question, and people got pretty much the same. He got pretty much the same response that I'm getting now, and he was silent for a moment, and then he said, "You know," he said, "Colombia is a beautiful country.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. It's a beautiful country." And
who's fighting who?
Who's fighting who? That's a good question. And the fighting it's hard to know where to begin. But the importance, I think, for us is not to begin with the war on drugs, because even though that's the beginning of our country ratcheting up its aid to Colombia and its support in terms of military equipment and training, The conflict in Colombia goes back a long time, probably 100 years. But really, for our purposes, we can maybe talk about the conflict that took place for about a 10 or 20 year period between 1949 and the early 60s, where drugs were not an issue. It was a conflict that was related to who had control of the land and the resources of that land. A lot of the problems even today is that a lot of the best land is owned by people of wealth, and poor people don't have access to the most fertile areas of the country. And so it was an economic conflict in many ways, and during that period another 2 million people were displaced, and hundreds of thousands of people were killed during that time. It's only more recently that cocaine has become coca has grown, when the president before the current president was named Pastrana, and when he was elected, he sort of was involved in a plan that would be equivalent to our Marshall, sort of the European Marshall Plan, to develop the country economically and get rid of the coca production, try to solve the problem of the counter the guerrillas and the warfare that was going on. And he had this plan called Plan Colombia, and it was a more exhaustive plan. But what happened was that the U.S. Sort of came in. The European community was willing at that time to come in and provide some of what we call the social and economic development for the country, resources to help with that. And the U.S. was going to provide some of the military aid to counter the coca production and eradicate the coca, the growth of the coca plants. And what happened was that the U.S. Really was pushing, because Colombia is the primary source of cocaine in our country. We came in primarily at the time of under Clinton's leadership, and the drug czar in this country was McCafferty, is that was his name? Basically, it was out of that combination of folks who decided to basically make it a war on drugs. And a great amount of money was proposed. Well, what happened was the Europeans decided to drop out because they didn't feel that was going to be a very effective way of doing, in fact, endanger the work that they would be doing on economic developments. And so they haven't been in the picture very much recently. There are still Europeans there who are working, but they don't have very much visibility, and the amount of money that they're contributing does not amount to a great deal. The Plan Colombia proposed 1.2 billion dollars the first year, and then another 1.3 the second year. So a lot of money now. This is in 2000 and then 2001. About $2.5 billion has already been spent. Another $700 million was appropriated last year. So Colombia is now the third behind Israel and Egypt. Colombia is the third highest country receiving foreign aid from the United States. And unfortunately, what makes it so high is, like Israel and Egypt, the primary funding is military hardware. Now, that doesn't mean that all of the money that U.S. has been pouring into Colombia is military aid. Between, depends on what year of appropriations, but it's between 10 and at the most 20% of that aid has been designated for what's called alternative development. We'll talk a little bit about that. Reform of the judicial system. It's pretty hard to get a fair trial in Colombia. The system is fairly corrupt, so support the rule of law and the reform of the judicial system in the country. Improvement of human rights, because human rights violations are, anybody who's working in human rights work is really doing it at some personal risk in that country. What's happened most recently, also, just in the last year, the church community, this didn't happen up until about a year ago, but now the church community has become the focus for some of the, or has been targeted for some of the attacks. Over 200 congregations, and this is both Catholic and Protestant, over 200 congregations have been completely wiped out and destroyed. 35 clergy have been killed in that country. So that it used to be that the clergy or church workers weren't really bothered too much, but now because they've become involved and a little more outspoken about the issues, they've also come under attack. What we're looking at is, in terms of the armed, what we call the armed actors, the guerrilla groups consist of two groups. The FARC is the name. These are acronyms for the Spanish spelling of the name of the unit, FARC, and then the ELN. They operate in different parts of the country. They have a little different history to them. The FARC is the oldest group. They've been around. They're basically sort of left-wing socialist groups that started out as sort of land reform groups trying to equalize some of the inequities in the country economically against some of the policies of the government that favored the rich at the expense of the poor, but they basically become involved in the narcotics. All of the armed actors have become involved themselves in the narcotics traffic. That's how they get their money. They tax the people who are growing the cocoa, or they actually are involved themselves in processing that cocoa and getting it out of the country. So the FARC was the early guerrilla group, and then more recently the ELN, which really is another left-wing group that represents the more middle class in Colombia in terms of a political movement, but themselves also have become, their main income, since because of where they're located, is another source of, well, both sides do this, and that's kidnappings. One of the things they do is kidnap people, hold them for ransom. Luis's own cousin was kidnapped last year, held for about 4 or 5 months, and his family finally got the money together to really, he was kidnapped with another person, and they killed the other person because the family did not come up with the money they wanted, and his cousin was able to return to his family, but his family is pretty much destitute or have very little resources left because they, and this happens at many levels, especially their favorite target, of course, is anybody who has money, so a lot of the expatriates who are there representing foreign countries are targeted as well. The ELN also targets the pipeline. There's a very important oil pipeline that runs, I think, about 500 miles, and it's a target of the guerrillas. They get the oil company to pay them protection money for not blowing it up. And then, of course, they blow it up every once in a while to make sure that they can do it. And then it's a very complicated thing. And then the other piece of this is what's called the guerrilla groups. And then on the other side are the right-wing paramilitaries, and they were formed initially as people who were hired by the wealthy landowners to protect their property. A lot of cattle ranches, a lot of large agribusiness activities. The paramilitaries were hired to protect their lands, to fight the guerrillas, but they have more and more recently become involved in, maybe not so recently, they become involved in drug operations as well. That group has begun to splinter in recent months, I guess maybe more than a few months. One of the splinter paramilitary groups has sort of come out and disassociated themselves from the others because the others are involved in drug operations, and they're trying to say that we aren't involved in that kind of activity. So they don't. And the government right now, and then of course you have the army. A lot of the source of all of these groups, the army isn't doing it anymore, but all of these groups recruited children, young people, to join them. Let me just...
I think, can you really separate the paramilitaries from the military, though? I mean, there is a definite link between the two.
Yes, there's a link. There's a definite link between the two, and that's one of the difficulties in one of the criticisms that we have about the way in which we're funded. I mean, we send a lot of military equipment and supplies, but if you looked at the equipment that the paramilitary has, it would be, I mean, except for maybe the real large, you know, jet airplanes and other things. But basically, it's the same equipment that the military has, and many of their commanders are people who have served in the army and who are offered a better deal with the, you know, with the paramilitary. They can pay more, so a lot of people will go and join the paramilitary. And there are and the other piece that's happened is that there's been a lot of criticism of the army for human rights violations, killing of civilians, and most of the people, as the figures were used the other, 1 out of 10 are really killed in combat. Of the people who are killed in violence in Colombia, 9 out of 10 are civilians. But the army, because it's been criticized for human rights violations, and because Congress finally, that's one of the things we were able to do in the legislation, attach some strings to the legislation that required certain standard of human, adherence to human rights, or certain lack of violations before the funding would flow. The Army has not, because they want to appear clean of human rights violations, they basically are in collusion. The paramilitary does their dirty work. They go out and do that because then they can say, we aren't doing that. So they can continue to receive the money. But in spite of the documentation, Amnesty International, a lot of other international organizations have documented the human rights violations. And even though the Army is still guilty of that, there's pressure from, beginning with Clinton, who completely overrode the violations and signed the order for the money to flow anyway, up to the present time, when those violations are still being disregarded in terms of the flow of money and resources. So that continues to be a problem. You mentioned, I'm sort of skipping around here, but I want to just sort of throw a lot of things out and then we can talk and ask questions. One of the things that that I didn't know about Colombia until recently, I knew about the coffee, and I knew about the oil, but I didn't know about the fact that 1 out of every 2 cut flowers that are sold in this country come from Colombia. One out of every two cut flowers in this country. That's a lot of flowers because, you know, 80,000, mostly women, work in those plants to grow those flowers and under very unsafe environmental conditions because of the lack of enforcing safety regulations. But the other thing I didn't know about is coal. 7% of Colombia's export is coal. Coffee used to be much more than it is now because of the worldwide depression in coffee. They used to process, I think, around, let me make sure I have the figures here, but they used to well, aside from cocaine, of course, petroleum, oil, accounts for $4.5 billion in exports. That's 35% of Colombia's legal exports. And the second largest export is coal. This is in terms of the dollar value now. And then in 10 years ago, the country produced 16 million sacks of coffee annually. Currently, they only export 9 million. So you can see it's not quite been cut in half. So that potential just isn't being realized now. And that's one of the reasons why, and because of the problem of the flow of oil on that pipeline, the war on drugs has been now expanded. It began, in terms of the legislation, to be a war on drugs, and then 2 years ago it was expanded to be a war on what would support the counterinsurgency effort of the government to fight the guerrillas. And then, most recently, last year, I think $97 million was added to the Colombia package to provide protection for that oil pipeline. So very specifically, you know, we're using U.S. taxpayer dollars to protect a pipeline that is owned by, not completely owned by U.S. interests. It's an international oil company, but a portion of the oil or the resources from that oil company are owned here in the United States. So there's a lot of Let's talk about the war. Let's talk about how effective the war, or ineffective as that case may be, of the war on drugs. The production of an export of cocaine has not been reduced, even though our effort there has been primarily to eradicate the coca. I mean, I don't know what we've been sending the money down there for. I mean, the planes are flying, they're trying to get rid of the coca, and it's not happening. It's actually, the amount of coca that's being produced in the area is actually growing. Now, why is that? Well, last year they were able to reduce the number of acres that were actually used to grow coca in Colombia. But what has happened is that they've introduced better, just like the Green Revolution in Asia in the 60s, they've introduced better strains of coca, and they've actually been able to keep the production up there. But also what's happened is that it's just like a balloon. When you squeeze Colombia production of coca, what happens? Where does it go? If the planes are coming over and getting rid of the coca, you go somewhere else to grow it, right? So they're going further and further into the forest where it's much more difficult to get it, to get to it and get rid of it. But more important than that, what's happened is that coca production is going up in neighboring countries, primarily Bolivia and in Peru. So where they have experienced some gains in previous years in reducing the amount of coca in those countries, now coca production is going up in Colombia, in the Andean region. The criticism of the war on drugs has been, the RAND Corporation is a very conservative think tank in Washington, D.C. And a number of years ago, they came out with a study that said, if you take the same amount of money that we are spending to try to stop drugs at the source and use it in terms of treatment and prevention in the place where the demand is, it's, I don't know how they do these studies, it's 23 times more effective. So the question that we're raising, we're spending all of this money, why not spend at least more, a portion of that money on prevention and treatment in this country, where and Europe as well, because U.S. and Europe are the primary demand sources for that. The other thing of this is that aerial eradication has tremendous harmful effects, both on displacement, because what happens is that when the planes fly over and release these chemicals, it's obviously not good for people and animals. It kills everything. It doesn't distinguish between the coca plants and the food, or between an animal and a coca plant. It destroys everything that it touches. So you have people that are forced to move, and you have some environmental impact to Roundup. That's the type of product it is. It's sold under Roundup, but except there are chemicals that are added to it to make it a little more, even more powerful than it is in terms of use each year. So what the Colombians themselves are telling us is that we don't want coca. It's not as though they're wanting to encourage this in their economy. They want to get rid of coca production. But they're saying a more economical way, a more reasonable way, a more ecological way to get rid of it is to do manual eradication. So that, first of all, you have high unemployment in Colombia. You have unemployment official figures as high as 30-35%. But the actual figures are higher than that because there are people that have just given up looking for work. A couple of years ago, a notice went up. They needed somebody to clean out the sewer pipes under the streets of Bogota. They had an opening for 35 jobs, short-term jobs. They had 1,500 people show up to apply for that work. So there's tremendous unemployment in that country. But if you pay people to pull up those plants, you're putting money into the local economy. Those people are hopefully know enough to know a coca plant from a cassava plant or whatever food that's being grown. So you have, and then you don't have that environmental impact. It's not without its problems, but it's also seems to be a much more friendly way to get rid of it. And the vast amount of money that we're spending for aerial eradication is it isn't really doing the job in any way. The other thing that we're arguing for is alternative development. There is money that's being set aside. We're saying spend more of that. If you want to spend money in Colombia, the country certainly needs it. It needs development. People need jobs. When we talk about alternative development, let's talk about also developing the infrastructure that can support that alternative development. What has been happening is that some of that money has been going into areas where there's been drug production. They've gotten rid of the coca growers and they introduce another crop, but they don't put in the infrastructure to get those crops to market. Coca leaves the country in a sort of an underground way, and you can't use that those same methods of getting palm oil to market. You need roads, you need markets, you need other things, and many times they've gone in trying to develop a crop without the infrastructure to make that happen. The other thing, when it's done large scale, also, U.S. companies have come in, and we set, one of the things that we did is we've had Colombians come over who are experts in alternative development, and we've had them meet with the companies here in this country that are doing alternative development, and we've had them say this is the reason it isn't working well, and one of the reasons is that is the scale. A lot of companies come in, and because it's large scale, they bring the experts from the U.S. and they hire people who are not local people, so that they completely disrupt the local authorities and the system of transparency, so that there's a civil society that is there long after they leave. And then they leave, and then the system breaks down, and then they wonder why. It's because they haven't utilized the local resources and the local people and empowered the local, mayors and elected officials and hired local people. It just seems to be, we just don't seem to be doing things very wisely because it has to be such large scale. So these are some of the problems that we're facing there. The other thing is that the impact on the internally displaced is very disproportional. And only about 20% of the people who are actually displaced are eligible to receive help. There are laws in the country on the books to require certain, people to be, to be helped. But the problem that you face is that they cannot receive funding from the United Nations, because the United Nations could only provide money to support refugees. And as long as you stay within the borders of a country, you're not considered a refugee. So if you're internally displaced, you don't come under those kind of humanitarian efforts. The other thing is within the country itself. If you're displaced because of aerial fumigation, you aren't considered, even counted as internally displaced. So there's all kinds of sort of catch-22 situations where there are tremendous needs, but because of the laws that are in place, you can't respond. So the burden falls on private non-government organizations, humanitarian agencies. I think I'll just stop talking and just give you a chance to ask questions, because I've talked long enough. Anybody?
So what can we do?
What can we do? That's always a question. Well, you can sign up the list here to get it. First of all, you can sign up to be on a network to receive, because we need to know about this. You can't expect people to make contact with their members of Congress if they don't know about it. You have to know about it before you can care. There was a very critical vote last just in the week before I left to come here. And it was the Foreign Operations Bill was up in the House to vote on it, for a vote in the House. And there was an amendment that came out. One of the good guys, as we call them, introduced an amendment. Actually, it was a bipartisan group of House members that would have removed not a large amount, but about $75 million from the Plan Colombia account and give it to HIV/AIDS in Africa. So we were supporting that amendment because we thought it sort of served a dual purpose for us. It took money out of the military aid, which we didn't like to see going on, and it actually gave it to HIV/AIDS. And we worked on that for about a week in terms of making phone calls. The vote was very close, and there were a lot lot of people absent for one reason or another, and the boat finally came at 1 o'clock in the morning. As you can imagine, at 1 o'clock in the morning, not everybody's going to be there. But it was about, we lost by about 26 votes, which isn't a lot of votes. I mean, it's, you know, it was like 220-something to 190-something. So it says that there's not an overwhelming majority that is favoring. And the vote before that, which called for the removal of the money for the support of that pipeline, that only lost by 9 votes. And that was earlier this year. So as we feel that we have been able to make a difference. The most dramatic thing for us was last March, a year ago in March, we brought a group of Colombians here, and we brought them out to South Dakota, Minnesota, and Iowa in targeted districts. And in South Dakota only has one representative. And that representative, we thought we had an advantage because they were Lutheran, first of all. But that was the good part. The bad part was that this person had never voted the way we wanted him to vote, ever, on Columbia. And when we went to his office, we never got to talk to him. We got to only talk to his aides. But because of that trip out there to his district, he was flooded. He was really, literally flooded with phone calls and letters from his constituents. And on the next vote opportunity that came up, he changed his history of voting. Unfortunately, he didn't run for office the next time. He's not there anymore. So we've got to start all over again. He decided to run for Senate. I mean, he didn't lose the election. He decided to run for Senate. So that's for the problem. Back there.
Yeah, question, how would you characterize the current Bush administration's attitude and intention and policy towards Colombia now?
Well, one of the things that I didn't, that's important to mention, that gives you the framework for answering your question, is that the Pastrana, under which plan, Pastrana was the president of Colombia when this Plan Colombia started. And then his term, you could only serve, I think, 1 6-year term, and then he was out of office. And the new president, Uribe, who's in place now, was elected with a lot of popular support from the people who are just getting sick and tired of this conflict. And they wanted a strong military person whose agenda was to solve the problem militarily. The feeling was that with a strong president, they felt that Pastrana was just messing around in terms of the peace process. It wasn't aggressive enough militarily against the guerrillas. And so the new president has come and has been elected and has a lot of popular support from the people who want peace. And the feeling is that the only way we can have peace is to get the resources we need to militarily conquer the guerrillas, as well as the paramilitary, but they're sort of more on the side of the army, but they're still a problem. Paramilitary, as well as the guerrillas, since 9/11 have been declared one of the terrorist organizations. But coming to answer your question, there's a lot of strong support in the White House for supporting Plan Colombia and increasing the military aid. One of the things, and the support is not as strong in the State Department, but the State Department isn't, as you know, isn't really running things these days. I mean, they are influential, but they aren't as strong as the Pentagon in terms of the power and the decisions that are being made. It's not that they would maybe do things a lot differently, but they aren't as probably aggressive as the White House has been. But the I had another thought that just skipped it, went out of my head. It had to do with your question. Terrible. I'm just having a senior moment here, folks.
It'll come back.
It was an important thing, but.
So does Bush back this military? In other words, does Bush want to crank up the military and the American military presence there?
I think they do. They're not coming asking for remember that question because I just remembered what I was going to say. This is terrible. In 2 days time, we had this Columbia delegation, a wonderful group of people, one person who herself had been internally displaced, who saw her own father beheaded by the guerrillas and her brother killed in front of her, to leave, told a powerful story in these offices. We were in 24 offices in 2 days, and we saw many of them were staff members, but many times we got into senators and representatives' office. When we were in one office after we left, the staff member came to Luis and said, you know, we need more of these voices. I mean, we hear, you know, you come in, people from the church community, people, Americans come in and tell us we shouldn't be sending all this military aid. But he said, we don't hear the voices of ordinary Colombians who are being affected by this violence. We don't hear their voices in our office. He said, instead, hardly a week goes by that we don't get a Colombian from the business community coming into our office telling us to send more military aid to our country to solve our problems. So this is what we're up against. I mean, it's again the unevenness in terms of, I mean, we don't have, it took a lot of resources, we thought, and tremendous time to work out the visas for these people to come. That was incredible in and of itself, especially post 9/11. So that's the issue. But Bush isn't saying we need to send more money down there. He's saying we've got enough money to do the job, but I don't think they're willing to shift some of that money that we would like to see to more equitably support the impact on the indigenous community for displacement and the Afro-Colombian community, which are tremendously, I mean, they're the marginalized people who are really hurting, or to shift some of that money for alternative development of the kind that we're talking about. So there still is a commitment to solving this militarily, but they are not, I don't want to give the impression that our government is entirely happy with the way the war is being conducted by, you know, I mean, they're not totally, they're uncomfortable by the human rights violations. I don't want to give that picture. They don't like to see that going on. But there's such deceitful ways of getting around, you know, we go out and hire non-military people to fly the airplanes to do the dirty work down there. I mean, that's what we're doing.
We're limited to 500 uniformed military
personnel.
That's
right. There's limitations on it.
We hire contractors to do a lot of the dirty work.
That's right. Mm-hmm. It's sort of the same thing that they're doing down there in terms of the paramilitary. I mean, we are doing the human rights violations. They're over here with the paramilitary. So it's just, there was a question here.
I had an embassy question. Back about 20 years ago, I remember hearing that if a representative or a senator were to receive 80, that was the number, 80 direct personal communications from their constituency, that could very well result in an influence on a vote. I'm just wondering, do you have an idea, Reed, right now from your office, as to how many personal communications are influential from constituent groups? Any read on that at all?
I have an answer for that. I'd like Diane to answer that. You've been involved for so long in advocacy work, and I'm prejudiced because that's the work that I'm involved in. So I think some there's been some shifts that I want to talk about, but what do you think, Diane?
Well, and I really don't know the answer. I'd actually heard a small, I've heard things like as many as just like six letters causing a congressional.
I've never heard that by
person,
figure before.
Yeah, put somebody on an issue and start taking a look at it. Mm-hmm. But are you going to talk about how advocacy has been affected by 9/11? Because we used to do a really different form of advocacy than maybe we
that's
need to be doing
was,
right now.
That's what I was going to get
good.
To. Yeah. The numbers that she, the numbers, if you can generate, when we go in and talk about an issue, they can say, open the file and say, where are the letters? If I have no letters, if I have no phone calls, that's a, did you want to interrupt me? It's my wife, I'll let her interrupt me.
one of the things that we tried to do last summer at a global mission event was send a flood of letters to allow our bishop to talk, be able to go with religious leaders to the White House. Yeah. Nothing.
But I wonder,
nothing.
Can I just follow up on that? A flood of letters, and I've been involved in some of those campaigns too, where they have a form letter or a card, and I'm wondering if there's a distinction, isn't there, influence between form or a...
Yeah. Well, I can tell you what happened after 9/11. We were completely shut down. We couldn't even get appointments in offices. Nobody wanted to talk. I was more than Columbia. We were working on debt issues. We were working on trade issues, and nobody was listening. Nobody wanted to talk to us. Their minds were elsewhere. We were totally caught up in how are we going to finance this? What are we going to do? To try to get more funding for HIV/AIDS. It was just very difficult to do. The other thing is, with the anthrax scare in the post office, you couldn't get the letters. The letters weren't even being delivered. So writing letters, it still is a problem. We're telling people to, if they're writing letters, that they should send them to their home. To their home districts. Most all members of Congress have district offices. The other problem you have with that in the age of email, it's so easy to send a flood of email. If an email doesn't have your home address on it, and if you are not in the district, it's not even recorded in the office. Faxes will work. That's what we do. Phone, we tell people if you want, phone, if it's something urgent like some of these alerts, phone calls and faxes. And my philosophy has always been, everybody thinks that advocacy has to be done in Washington. I think the most effective advocacy, when you think of actual personal contact with representatives or getting your message across, is in the home district. All of those people come home. They have to come home to get their face in front of their constituents, or they'll forget who they are the next time they run for office. So in our sort of grassroots work, I'm asking our people, when they go out to train people at the local level, get an appointment in the local office and go in with the people to show, if you want to model how this is done, to get access. Because they're very, when I lived in Nebraska, everybody in Washington came back and they had public meetings. Anybody could go to those meetings and anybody could stand up and ask a question. And so one of the things that you can do is, even if you don't know the answer yourself, you can just, stand up in a meeting and ask this question. And what it does, it puts it on their agenda. And that's it. And the other thing is, writing, and this, when you pick up things in here, you'll see that there's sample letters to write to editors in the paper, because even though your letter may not, a letter may not get through to their office, you can be sure that every one of them has staff in their office who's clipping out the letters of a once in a week little weekly newspaper. If something is written in and it's on a topic of national importance. They will clip it and put it in their file. It's added to that file of people registering an opinion. And it does make a difference, but it does require persistence, and it requires, you know, that wonderful story of that woman who came, you know, bothering the judge in the middle of the night. You know, he just sort of agreed to get rid of her. I mean, that's what we have to be. We have to become kind of thorns I shouldn't say that. Erase that from the tape. But those are. Oh, we've gone past the hour. Way past the hour. I'm sorry, I didn't look at the time. Thank you for coming to this session. He's probably turned off. Time is up. Yeah. Take a look at this. Help yourself to any of these. If you want a nice poster, you can take that.